Welcome to Flipping the Script. I'm Lindsay Cuiava, your host and the artistic director of Re Theater, an online theater and education consulting company. Each week, we bring you new episodes about the theater world and theater education in an effort to revolutionize the way that theater is seen at the school and community level and inspire you to make art that matters wherever you may be. Welcome back to another episode and happy 2020, everybody. I am so excited for what 2020 has in store and for the podcast, and I just can't wait to be sharing more awesome interviews that we've been collecting with you all. So we're going to kick off 2020 with a fantastic conversation with Carrie and Kareem from Animal Engine. If you're not familiar with Animal Engine, you will be by the end of the podcast, because this podcast really dives deeply into what Animal Engine does, how they create their work, and all of that. Like, if you are interested in devising or the creation of your own work, or really if you're thinking about going to grad school or any of that, like, we are going to talk extensively about that in this episode. It's just a really fascinating conversation. Kareem and Carrie, I have so much respect for both of them individually and collectively as artists and the way that they create work. So I just think it's going to be a really fun episode for any of you that are really interested in the inner workings of how theater works. So like I said, we're going to dive deeply into Animal Engine and Carrie and Kareem's work in the episode. But if you are not familiar with Animal Engine, they are a touring theater company whose mission is to make old stories new by creating and performing uniquely physical plays that reimagine classic works of literature for the stage. We'll dive into what all that means. But before we do that, on a quick side note, if you happen to be in New York City or you are coming to New York next weekend, Flipping the Script is going to be at BroadwayCon, and I would absolutely love to see you there. We have a booth. I will be there. I'll be hanging out. We'll be talking about all things theater, especially musical theater, because, you know, it's me, and about the podcast. And we also will be selling some really fun theater nerd merch, so come over and say hey. Why don't we jump into the episode and hopefully see some of you guys next week at BroadwayCon. Joining me today.
Yeah, it's our pleasure.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. We were talking a little bit before the episode started, and I'm just so excited to dive into more of the work that the two of you do, because it's so unique. And I was like totally stalking you guys on the internet yesterday and today, like just like watching all the videos and everything. And it was so the one thing I will totally say. So before this started, we were talking about how it's so important that artists are able to articulate their work. And your like website and all of the information about like what you do is so well articulated.
Thank you. We've worked a lot on that. So that's nice to hear.
Been years coming.
Yeah. No, and it's because it is like when I was like reading about The Darlings or about Petunia and Chicken, I was like, and then I watched the video, I was like, oh, this totally like makes sense and it matches up. So because sometimes you'll be like, oh, that's a cool thing. And then you're like, wow, that was not the explanation of it at all.
Right.
Yeah, well, I think when you're running your own company and creating your own work, so you're not just making the work, but you're also marketing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose marketing sometimes has a sort of, it exists in people's minds a bit negatively.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it can be really useful, actually, because it forces you to think about how people are perceiving your work and how to communicate it to them.
Yes.
So it sort of became a necessity, I think, through selling our work to be able to talk about it clearly.
Yeah. And did either of you have a background in marketing or?
No, not at all. You know, we sort of grew up on the fringe circuit. And, you know, you have to sell your shows on, you have to sell them to people and you have to learn how to talk to people and put it into a elevator pitch and, you know, put, you know, have a 500 word description on the back of a postcard. I guess that's a lot.
That is a lot.
Yeah.
Maybe 50 words.
Yeah, 50 word description on the back of a postcard. So I think that's really how we sort of honed our marketing skills.
Yeah.
No, it's so essential in as artists. And you guys are really, I'm super excited to talk a little bit about like the like production of your own work or producing your own work, because it's such a different skill set than just like being a performer. And so you had mentioned Fringe, and this is actually a question that has come up on the podcast before. And can you explain Fringe for the audience? Because I think people have like a very, like there's a lot of different connotations and all of them are kind of like this weird thing over here. It's very popular in Seattle, but like for the rest of the country, like what is Fringe?
So the Fringe Festival, I think probably first came up in Edinburgh. It was sort of, there was this arts festival that was juried and was only letting in certain shows. And so a bunch of artists just decided that they were going to be on the fringe of that and put up their own shows. And eventually the Fringe overtook the sort of juried artist festival. And that was maybe what, 50 years ago or something like that. I'm not sure, but but since then it's really grown into a worldwide phenomenon. There's a couple dozen in the States. That's really big in Canada. In Europe, there are a few. And they are festivals of usually artist-made theater that maybe doesn't get produced in bigger theaters or but still has great artistic merit.
I heard it described once as the YouTube of theater.
Oh, that's a really good description.
Yeah, YouTube, anybody can upload something.
Yeah.
And the audience decides. And Fringe is the same way. There's no gatekeepers. Mm-hmm. There's no producer to convince. Mm-hmm. No booking agent to convince. There's a lottery or a first come, first serve situation. And then you get to have direct access to the audience.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So did both of you, when you were young and like going into your undergrad, was this like, was the Fringe circuit like where you wanted to go, or like what was like your undergrad dream?
No, I think I thought I was gonna be a Broadway star.
Yeah, me too.
You know, I think I didn't realize that there were other options, really, you know.
Well, Fringe is rather new, and so I think a lot of the faculty, at least at my college, probably weren't aware of.
Sure.
The rising tide of self-producing artists.
Yeah, like the oldest Fringe in the country is like 25 years old.
Oh, okay.
So, so when I was in college, how old would I have been? So that would have been, the Fringe would have only been like 5 or 6 years old.
Okay.
You know? It wouldn't have really necessarily reached the Midwest where I went to college, you know?
Yeah.
You know, people wouldn't have really known what it was.
And where did you go to school?
The University of Nebraska, Lincoln.
Oh, okay.
That's where I got my undergrad.
That's where you got your undergrad.
Yeah.
Okay, and Kareem, where did you go?
Ithaca College.
Okay.
State of New York.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. Ithaca was like always like the school I wanted to go to, but had never have been able to go to.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, that's okay. So how did you guys find your way into Fringe then? Because you both went to like really well-respected like universities with programs. Like how did you kind of... What's the like journey to get to like here?
Well, we met in grad school.
Okay.
And so we went to this place called the London International School of Performing Arts.
Okay.
Which I always think is funny because it's a very vague name. It doesn't mean anything. But it was a 2-year training in the Jacques Lecoq pedagogy
of
physical theater and devising.
Oh.
And so that was where we met and learned about creating our own work.
Okay.
And learned a lot of techniques and tactics and approaches. And I had a little experience with Fringe before, just randomly in undergrad.
Okay.
But it seemed like an opportunity after graduate school to get our work seen.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And what made you, so what drew you to that school? Because that sounds like, if both of you are like, wanted to be like Broadway performers, that sounds like, very different than like, how did you get to going to that place?
I did a semester abroad in Northern Ireland in Derry.
Okay.
When I was in college, and the theater department there had a course in devising theater.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I started to dive into that, I was like, oh, this makes much more sense with my personality. Mm. So I just started researching places where I could learn that method.
Sure.
And LISPA was one of the top schools at the time. Yeah. So
yeah,
that's where I applied and I got in, and yeah, that's how I ended up there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what made you, okay, so I'm just curious. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So like you said, it was like much more in line with your personality. Like, what do you mean with that?
I think, well, so I'm super introverted and like auditioning and stuff is something that is not something I'm good at. But I'm super creative. I'm a good actor. Like, I'm able to do these things, but I sort of have to sneak up on people with it. Mm-hmm. Like, I have to create it and then show the thing that I've created rather than just having people cast me and like, yeah. So I think that's why it fits into my personality better. It's just because like, it's something that I can like, get into my creative space and create something to show rather than people like seeing my personality and then like deciding I'm the person for the role and like,
right.
Like that just didn't work for me. So, yeah. Yeah.
No, I'm just curious because I'm very much the same way. Like I'm very introverted and auditioning was like my worst nightmare. And I knew very early on in undergrad that was not going to be able to be the route I went. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of people that give up on the arts mm-hmm. or on acting because of that reason. I mean, I'm one of them, but that wasn't my path anyways. But like, there's a lot of, I have a lot of students. And so when you said that, I was like, oh, maybe I'm just curious because mm-hmm. there are a bunch of different ways to create art and to be an actor that don't have to go that like traditional audition route.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So that's kind of how you then fell into devising. Mm-hmm. What about you?
Well, for me, probably like a lot of people who go to undergraduate acting programs, I had a movement class
mm-hmm.
and I sort of struggled, I think, with the traditional Western approach to acting where sure. you're investigating the character's backstory and their psychology and what they want.
Uh-huh.
But we had a movement class my sophomore year, and mm-hmm. so we did viewpoints, and we did mask making, where we made full masks and we put them on, and we did Shakespeare soliloquies, and something really came alive in me, and all my classmates noticed it, and my teacher noticed it, and I noticed it, that going through a physical route
mm-hmm.
was really engaging for me. And so that was a real light bulb moment. And then, so I kept investigating those approaches through undergrad. And then I heard about this graduate program towards the end of undergrad. I was probably a little bit scared to move to New York right away, scared to be out in the real world.
But London was fine.
Yeah. Yeah. So I decided, why not?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you say Western approach, this is great because I always want to talk about this on the podcast and I haven't had anybody to talk about it with. So when you say Western approach, I think there's a really great example of like all the like Stanislavski and mm-hmm. like and Strasberg and stuff. And that's like, that's how I teach. And I'm like very analytical
uh-huh.
and I know it doesn't work for all my students. So like, what are other methods or ways of getting into like other non-Western methods of theater that you've kind of come across?
So I can give you a very brief sort of summary of Jacques Lecoq and yes. his approach.
Yeah.
So Jacques Lecoq, a Frenchman.
It's not so much Western. It's like American versus European.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. By the West, we mean the United States.
Oh,
North
okay.
America.
Interesting.
Right.
Okay.
So Jacques Lecoq from the West, right?
Yep.
From France. He began his adult career studying physical education.
Like gym, like PE. Okay.
Yeah.
Crazy.
And through that, he eventually found his way to theater.
Mm-hmm.
And so his approach to everything is through the body.
Okay.
Is through looking at the forces of the body. Mm-hmm. So I can look at a character and I can break them down based on what their objective is, what they want out of life, what their backstory is, where they come from, mm-hmm. all the different, you know, socioeconomic forces that have affected them over their life. But I can also look at a character and ask myself, what's their rhythm?
Mm-hmm.
What's their posture?
Mm-hmm.
What color do they move like? And that's also a way to get into the character.
Yeah. And ultimately, the audience doesn't know the psychology of a character. They know what they see.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, working physically, the more detailed you can be physically, the more, in our opinion, the more the audience is brought to the character emotionally.
Sure, you see it all the time where actors have a deep sense of what their character is thinking and feeling,
yes.
but aren't able to translate it in something that they can do and show the audience.
All the time,
and
right?
And so this is basically about, it's only about what the audience sees.
Right.
So when we would perform at LISPA in this Lecoq training,
mm-hmm.
They would never talk about what we were thinking or feeling.
Thank
they would just talk about what they observed.
Sure.
And in some cases, that's a lot healthier way to work, I think, because if you can make your body look sad, but you don't actually have to be sad.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you work psychologically or like methodly,
yeah,
you have to get to that place where you're sad every night, and that's a tough place to be.
Right.
You know?
Well, and it's where we see so many unhealthy acting habits come from, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's something. So I am very analytical, and so I like that, like that approach, like the psychological approach. But
sure, and it's important to have that. We yeah. also get there after our
sure.
all physical work. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But I always struggle though with like, I'm like, but you don't get like, don't think about your dog dying to cry on stage. Like,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
don't relive trauma. Like, you can't. Like,
right.
you have to protect yourself emotionally,
mm-hmm.
And it's really tough. And so I was a dancer and a choreographer, so like I do a lot of physical stuff, but I think that's one thing that I see, and you guys work with kids a lot too. So like I see so many of these approaches, like these method or these like psychological approaches being applied to kids, and like they don't know how to process
it. Yeah.
Or like how to get themselves out of it. And you guys go to the Thespian Festival. So you, I don't
yeah.
know if I have a really hard time sometimes watching the performances because I'm like, the emotional like rawness that those like young people
mm-hmm.
are having on stage, like is the, like, how do they get back out of that?
Mm-hmm.
And like,
mm-hmm.
and so that's a really interesting
sure.
idea.
Well, physically, I think it's how we play when we're young.
Yeah.
It's what comes natural to us. You tell a kid
so
to be whatever, a police officer or a dragon,
yeah.
and they instantly change their body, and changing the body, they believe it. And if you ask them, you know, how many scales does your dragon have? They wouldn't know. They might figure it out in the moment.
Sure.
But they don't need to do a bunch of work to become the dragon.
Right.
They just play.
Yeah. So it was a lot of it just like getting rid of all those like societal like schemas or like things that we put on to get away from play, like as we grow up, like that realism
yeah.
is that, like stripping that back so you can actually just get your mind to like play again. And
I mean that like that was like the first year of our training, and it was just like stripping us down and just like getting us to a neutral state, you know, where we were able to play.
Yeah, there's three sort of tenets
tennis.
There's three tenets of Lecoq, sort of the whole training, but particularly in the first year. There's le jeu, or the play,
okay.
playfulness. Then there's complicité, or ensemble. And then there's neutrality, like physical awareness. Mm-hmm. And so they spend one whole year just getting you in touch with all of those things. And then the second year, you look at root forms of theater. So you look at tragedy, you look at commedia dell'arte, you look at clown, you look at something called bouffant, you look at melodrama or epic storytelling. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at those forms of theater, you analyze them through the body, through the dynamics of them in space. Mm-hmm. And then you're supposed to take all of that learning from these root forms of theater and then use them as you will to make your own theater. So you're using them as a launching pad. You're studying sort of the historic base for all the sort of primary colors of all theater. Mm-hmm. So then you can combine and make your own work.
Yeah. And so then do you guys have, which of those like are you, do you gravitate towards or like do you pull from when you create or do you all of them or?
Melodrama, clown.
Yeah. Melodrama is just a good story. It's just a really good epic story where people in Lecoq, they refer to it as the push and the pull. Everything's in physical vocabulary. Mm-hmm. So you think about something like Titanic, the movie Titanic, you know, Rose is torn between her duty to her family and her love for Jack. And that mirrors the differences between the classes in that time period. And it's mirrored in the destruction of the ship itself. And so there's all this physical push and pull, or like Gone with the Wind is like an epic drama. Mm-hmm. And so that's just always a really fun style because
it's exciting. I think in our work, we like to tell like literal stories, which there are plenty of like companies who are more abstract in their storytelling and don't do like a plus B equals C storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And they're really good at it and it's great, but we like to tell,
stories.
Mm-hmm. So I think the melodrama really lends itself to our sensibilities.
And probably clown,
I think, is also just like
for our play
personalities. And so there's something really interesting with the juxtaposition of like the playfulness and silliness of the clown with the like epicness of a melodrama that I think is something that we really feel in our hearts is really interesting. So we keep going that direction.
Yeah.
And it served us, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned clown. So both of you have done clowning. Is that how you came? Is that like, was that because of what you did in grad school or were you interested in that before or?
I got into it through grad school. It's one of the areas that we explore. And after grad school, I got into it a little bit more and I took some deeper workshops a few times.
And we don't actually,
we don't wear noses.
Yeah, we don't really clown the way you might recognize it.
Yeah.
But there's this underlying idea of le jeu, the playfulness of the clown. And so if you can create from that playful state.
Okay.
You can open up a lot of possibilities.
So clowning is more than just like being silly. Like, there's a whole methodology behind it. Is that true?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, like, can you give us like a brief, like, what is like the methodology of like clowning? Because I'm really fascinated. There was a clown troupe at where I went to high school, but only the popular kids could be in it. And I really desperately wanted to be in it because I was like, oh, it's acting things. And that's the only thing I could be cool at with. But so I've always been curious because I've only seen clowning done in a like trying to be funny or do shtick like stuff. Yeah. So I was curious.
So I think at the root, so they say like, clown is the smallest mask, so it doesn't cover up much of yourself. So it's really just learning to be like comfortable with being yourself on stage and responding to what's happening to you and what's happening in the room in the most organic and natural way. So, I mean, at the root of it, it's just being a really good actor, right?
Yeah.
And then you can find games on top of what, like, if you hear a noise and you respond to it. It's funny, or, you know, and like, it's finding the rhythm of the game that you're discovering. And, you know,
It's why you can't really teach clown to small children. Because they're already doing it.
Yeah.
And so it's about getting back in touch with that.
You can teach them like circus skills. Sure. You know. But like, yeah, the root of clown is sort of, and so I've taught some clown at the Thespian Festival, and it's it's really interesting because kids when they're 14, 15, 16 are just putting on this mask of like of the world outside them and who they think they should be. They're trying on different masks at that time.
Yeah.
So to tell them to like, no, take all that off and just be like who you are. It's just like very powerful, but also terrifying and like, you know, and It's beautiful. It's one of my favorite art forms, I think. And by no means am I a master at it. But I think it's just a powerful and beautiful art form that has, you know, so much to give to the world. And I think it also has this negative connotation of like red noses and
big shoes.
Pennywise.
And even if you see really great professional clowns, people who are actually making people laugh for a living, even they don't wear really the big shoes anymore. Most of them don't wear noses anymore. They're more in line with Charlie Chaplin.
Yes.
Physical comedy.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's kind of how people can like have a reference point into kind of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Like you just said, not red noses and big shoes, like just like more the physical comedy.
We have a friend who has been in Big Apple Circus,
Ringling,
Cirque du Soleil. As a clown, but he doesn't refer to himself as a clown because of the like the what people think of when they hear the word clown. So he calls himself a physical comedian or just an actor.
Okay.
You know? Yeah. But like he's a highly skilled, brilliant clown, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
I am so fascinated, even more so now after talking to you two, about like the methodology and like just how you came to this work to talk about Animal Engine and the work that you create. So do you just want to give us like a brief overview of what Animal Engine is, and then we can just dive into way more?
Yes.
Great.
This is a great opportunity for me to practice delivering our mission statement.
Yes, this is amazing.
So Animal Engine creates uniquely physical plays that reimagine classic works of literature for the stage.
Okay.
It took us a while to get there.
It's beautiful, though.
Yeah. I think when we began, it really was just...
Let's make a play.
Yeah, that was the mission. The mission was, let's make a play
because
we have a similar training background and we like to spend time together.
Yeah.
And over time, we have found our way to creating two-person adaptations of classics, and I put classics in quotes because we could discuss what is a classic for a long time, and reinventing those works of literature through these two-person physical adaptations that are rooted in our training in the Lecoq pedagogy.
Sure. Okay, so now I'm curious, how do you define classic?
So a classic can be what is typically thought of as a classic.
Okay.
Your Grapes of Wrath, Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Those are considered part of the canon, classics.
I think we originally went into classics because you don't have to pay for the rights.
Yep.
Absolutely, yeah. We had to do older works. But now we're also exploring, okay, what is a classic? So can we highlight works that you wouldn't think of as classics, but we think are classics?
Sure.
So can we say, oh, this older work should be considered a classic. So one thing that's been kind of in a development phase for a long time is an adaptation of Nemo in Slumberland, the comic strip.
That's so cool. Okay.
We're still trying to figure out how to adapt it, but I don't think most people would think of a comic strip as a classic work of literature.
Sure.
But we would argue maybe it is.
Yeah.
And then in our current work that we're developing, we are looking at all of the children's books that feature rabbits in them.
Okay.
And we're looking at that as sort of a body of work through history.
Yeah.
You know, your Peter Rabbits, your Goodnight Moons, all of those stories.
Uh-huh.
And we're asking Velveteen Rabbit, can we now create a modern day story, a contemporary classic that's coming out of that lineage?
Okay.
So we're starting to sort of play with what we mean by classic a little bit.
Yeah. And so what works have you adapted in the past?
So we have a show based on the works of Willa Cather, particularly what's known as her Prairie Trilogy. So My Antonia, O Pioneers, Song of the Lark. She wrote about a turn of the 20th century Midwest, particularly Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
So we have sort of a mashup of her books that we've made into our own story. That show's called Petunia and Chicken. We also have a show based on Peter Pan. And we've put it through the perspective of the parents whose children have gone missing, and now they're grieving the loss of their children. We have a show. We made a show. Do we still have it? I don't know.
Uh-huh.
We made a show based on Gilgamesh, the oldest story ever told, ever known, that's sort of about like the importance of art and in times of like oppression.
Mm.
Yeah.
And we've made some other things over the year that haven't been adaptations of works of literature. So we've really just in the last couple of years centered ourselves around that.
Okay. And there are two person shows. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We've started to add
musicians,
a live musician
to
each of our shows, but that's in process.
Okay. So what is the process? Like, how do you guys select the work? Like what stories are you drawn to?
I mean, it has to be something that we just are interested in. And that's not a great answer, but I think it is a little bit mysterious how anybody picks anything to focus on.
Right.
So when we, to decide about this play Rabbit.
Right.
So which is going to be the new Rabbit story.
Mm-hmm.
We were at the Strand bookstore.
Okay.
And we're always kind of on the lookout for the next book to adapt.
Yeah.
And then we picked up I Am a Rabbit.
Okay.
You know that book?
Scary. No.
It's scary. It's a simple
two
like,
words per page type
thing.
Okay.
The pages are like made of cardboard. It's really thick.
Okay, sure.
And the phrases are like, I am a bunny. I smell the flowers. When it rains, everything
and
gets
like
wet.
And it's like the rabbit is just like this tiny little bunny in like overalls. And he just is like taking the space.
Yeah, physically,
like,
it's beautiful.
Yeah.
The simplicity of the poses and the joy. And so in that moment, we sort of looked at each other and went, oh.
This is interesting.
Like, there are so many books about rabbits. There must be something here. I want to put this joy on stage.
Okay.
And so I think it's about like there's some sort of like love of the book.
Yeah.
If you don't love the source material.
Yeah, you got to listen to your guts and just be like, if you feel that little like, this is fun, then go like follow that. Like for Petunia and Chicken, the one with Willa Cather, I just was like, I think we had discussed like we wanted to do like an epic love story. And I think we were originally looking at like the Hatfields and the McCoys as something to sort of adapt for the stage. And we were researching it. Nothing was really sparking us. And at the same time, like we were pretty new to New York, maybe only a year or two in. And I'm from Nebraska, and I was sort of like homesick for Nebraska, and went into a Barnes & Noble and saw My Antonia by Willa Cather. And I was like, oh, she's from Nebraska. And so I grabbed the book and just like ate it up. And I was like, Cream, you have to read this book. He ate it up. And
yeah.
then we just like kept reading her stuff, and like everything is just so beautiful and like touching. And so
and
yeah.
the same thing with Peter Pan. I remember we were struck. I had never read Peter Pan.
I've read it a
billion times. And I remember being struck by how dark it was. I thought,
yeah.
wow, this is really for children?
Okay.
Huh.
And that's where we were like, oh, we need to like really, because like, yeah, neither of us have ever seen the Disney version of Peter Pan.
Oh,
we've,
really?
That's right,
yeah. we've, it's always, I started just by reading the book.
Sure.
And... yeah, it's always struck both of us. I think I the first time I read it, I was an adult. So reading it, I was like, oh, this is not a kid's book. Like, I feel like there needs to be something that like really shines a spotlight on the darkness of this story. So.
Well, and if you want to hear some crazy stuff about J.M. Barrie.
Please. Like all the things.
So when he was young, I don't know if it was
his
older brother died.
Okay.
And then his mother essentially
fell into a
depression. She was bedridden. And sometimes J.M. Barrie would dress up like his dead brother and go to his mother, and it would give her solace. And so when you think about that,
wow,
in the context of Peter Pan, what that means,
wow,
it really gives you a sense
you
of
know,
the story.
There are like lines in Peter Pan of like of Mrs. Darling being like, she just has this like name, Peter Pan, floating around in her head, and she doesn't know where she heard it before, but she thinks maybe she heard it as a kid as Peter Pan being somebody who accompanied all the dead children to heaven, you know? And
wow. So once again, Disney has like totally just warped perceptions of the original story.
Right. Yeah. So you think of Neverland as like, all the lost boys being like these dead children that have been brought there, and like the darling children are there now, and like,
yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. Okay, because I like didn't love the movie the first time. I love Peter Pan too. It's a very weird thing about me. I love it. I think the music is like beautiful. It's like one of my favorite Disney movies. But super interesting because you're probably not familiar with it because you didn't ever see it. But like that one takes place when Wendy is a mom. But it takes place during the bombings of London. So like that whole like idea with it, like, wow, really makes that even more like heart-wrenching to watch than like, or to think about than like how heart-wrenching it already is, I think, adding that element into that story. So
yeah, it's nice to see the backdrop. I think we're really interested in who the storytellers are on stage and what is the backdrop for the story being told. It can add a great contrast.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I love that you're actually like excavating like what's going on in the work and bringing that to the stage. So like with that show, so the Darlings in particular, is that, because a lot of the work, Petunia and Chicken, you take and like do in schools. Was the Darlings one that you also did in schools or?
We have not done it in schools.
Okay.
It's... you know, I don't know. It's really dark. It's really focused on grief. And it's, we're not sure how to.
Yeah, we're still trying to find the audience for that one. It's also got a set. So
okay.
It's not the kind of show. So Petunia and Chicken, it's performed with literally just the clothes on our backs.
Mm-hmm.
So we can go into a cafeteria or an auditorium
and
put it up. But this show does have a set.
Yeah.
It breaks down into the trunk of our car. But it's still a set. And so... we're still trying to find, okay, what's the best community that would benefit from this work?
Yeah. And so when you performed that, has that been like in a more like traditional theater setting then where like you have an audience? Like,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So we performed Darlings primarily at fringe festivals.
Okay. Okay. Great. And so then like, so it seems like Petunia and Chicken is like very different than that. So how, what is the process? Is it the same process that you use for both of those pieces and now Rabbit? Like, do you go into whenever you create work the same way? Like through the same process, or like, how does like, when you get the idea, how do you like start to make it?
I think it's the same process.
Yeah. We always start with a super long and in-depth research period.
Yeah, we read the book several times. We look up
background information, anything pertaining to anything. Like for Petunia and Chicken, we also, like, as part of the research period, we also, like, we went to Red Cloud, where Willa Cather grew up and where a lot of her books are set. We watched, like, epic love story movies, like
East of Eden, stuff like that.
Yeah,
lots of dramatic stuff. For Peter Pan, we read the annotated Peter Pan's big thick tome with annotations on every page.
Read J.M. Barrie's book that he wrote about his mother.
So sort of dramaturgical work.
Yeah,
essentially.
Yeah, I'm just so excited. Yeah. And how long does that research period usually last for you?
It can last up to like about a year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, we're sort of takes time, I think, for things to soak in.
Yeah.
Yeah, and for us to, like, you know, sometimes we find inspiration in areas that we don't expect. So we want time to, like, delve into every corner.
Sure.
Yeah, I think concept is really important to us. All of our works are fairly high concept. And for Willa Cather, it's a mashup. For Darlings, it's reframing the viewpoint of the story. And for Rabbit, it's adding a new story to a lineage of stories. And so we spend a lot of time thinking, and usually the concept has emerged before we get in the room.
Okay.
We have a sense of, oh, this is what we want to do.
Yeah.
Even if we don't know the exact story.
Sure. Okay. And so do you actually, like, compile your research into, like, documents, or do you just kind of, like, float in your head?
Yeah, we have, like, some, like, Google Docs that
bookmarks in a web browser.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not being like, I'm like, you're probably like, well, that's a weird question. Because I know that a lot of teachers are teaching devising in classrooms, and a lot of teachers who don't have a background in it. And so I get a lot of questions about, like, well, how do I even do research with my students? And it's like, oh, well, I can teach you how to do the research, but it really depends on how you're going to create the work. Like, if you're, I hate when they have people do research and then don't, like, document it at all, because I'm like, it's going to go away. Then you're only going to remember the most recent or the most, like, poignant, which you need, but not always. You sometimes need those, like, finer details once you get into the process.
Well, I would say something that we always do save so we can take it into the workshop period after we research something is we try to have some visuals.
Okay.
So for Peter Pan, we found the original pictures that, like, went with the first edition. So we can sort of take on the physicality of those and see what's there. We also, you know, save bits of text from whatever book we're working on. So each of us might have a collection of a couple pages long of different passages that we can then start to work from. So that's definitely the thing that gets
or like
saved.
Clips of movies, like if we're doing, if like for Petunia and Chicken, we're like, definitely Kareem embodies what's the guy's name?
James Dean.
James Dean.
Yeah. James Dean in East of Eden is so dramatic and forlorn, and it's it's such a great inspiration.
Okay. Because
they're working in this larger style.
So
Or for Rabbit, you know, sometimes I think these things, I mean, there is a method to it, but I think it is also a bit random.
Yeah.
So when we started working on Rabbit, this movie Stan and Ollie had just come out in theaters about Laurel and Hardy. And so we watched this famous dance routine of theirs online. And there was just something about the joy of it that made us think of these Rabbit children's books.
Oh,
and so that show has a dance sequence in it.
It was simple and joyful, and it was just like, oh, this is in the same...
Style. So that gets saved, but there's not a good justification for why the research led there.
Sure.
It's almost, you know, we're all sponges just, and we pick up and we pick up.
Absolutely.
We work with a director who comes in after we've done everything, really, and just, like, tightens things up and reminds us to act. And
at the very end.
But a lot of times, you know, we have all these questions for her. Like, well, we really like this part, but we don't really know what it means. And da, 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 and she'll watch and she'll be like, you know what that means. Like, you know, so a lot of things, like, we just go with our guts. We mm-hmm. throw it out there, and like in the end, a lot of times it ends up being exactly what is needed to tell the story in a poignant way, I think.
Yeah. So what does that workshop phase look like for you?
It's kind of throwing everything against the wall.
Mm-hmm. At first,
I mean, we have, you know, exercises from our training that we'll do. So we might take a picture or a painting. So for example, with Darlings, we took these original pictures, etchings, yeah. and we moved them in our bodies. So we didn't embody them literally. We weren't taking on the physical poses of Peter and Wendy in those etchings.
Sure.
We were breathing and moving the rhythm and the texture of them. And that leads you to create a lot of different gestures and movements that become fodder mm-hmm. for the play. So we created some gestures that where we'd go, oh, that would be great for the Lost Boys. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's the moment when we go to Neverland.
Mm.
And so it's sort of not... it's interesting. If you move something physically, or we'll even move text, we'll move the texture of certain words
okay.
from the book. And if you put those in your body in a non-literal way, you'll still somehow get the meaning of that text and those pictures onto the stage somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I mean, it's so interesting. Yeah, I totally am tracking with you. I think it's like, it's so interesting when you talk about devising, right? And because everybody has their own methods, and it's not like... You go into the rehearsal room and you have a script and you right. do the table work and then you do the thing. Mm-hmm. So it's like fascinating. Like I always like love hearing how people explain their work. Mm-hmm. And it was beautiful how you explained it. So how long does that period then take for you that usually to develop?
It depends.
I mean, okay. maybe a couple months. Depends on how intense our rehearsal period is.
Sure. We generally try to have like a deadline of something that we are performing at. So okay, like a fringe festival or a scratch night or something that we have to have the work done by.
Okay.
So the workshop period kind of, so at a certain point in the workshop period, we've written down everything mm-hmm. that we want to save, that Got we like, it. All the ideas we've generated or the ideas we have for plot. And then we try to order those.
Yeah.
And actually dramaturgically, I guess, or as playwrights, mm-hmm. create the scene by scene structure for the piece. So here's the five act play.
Okay.
Here's a climax. Here's a resolution. Here's a story we're telling.
Yeah.
And then we set some sort of deadline where we have to show 15 minutes, 20 minutes. To push us to make the piece.
Yeah, there is at some point there does come a point where it's like, okay, we've explored everything. Now we just have like there's nothing more we can do than sit down and write.
Mm-hmm.
But the writing of the physical script, mm-hmm. the actual text comes last.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we go through each scene once we've postcarded it out, and then we stage it physically. We stage it for rhythm, for spacing, and we do a lot of, you'll hear lots of stuff like this in our rehearsals. Okay, and here I say something really slow. On here, there's some kind of like a da-da-da-da-da-da, cha-cha-cha, like a fast rhythm, and then it gets slow again. And so we sort of figure out what is the overall rhythm of the piece, and then we go back in and say, okay, but what words would I say that would fit that rhythm?
Okay.
So it's really about this sort of emotional arc.
Yeah.
And the feeling of it. And then we put in the sort of the meaning, the content.
Sure. Okay. That's awesome. And I think that's like really good, like ideas for educators, especially listening. Like if you're teaching playwriting, like that's a really interesting way to look at it as opposed to the traditional, which is so hard for young people. I mean, like sometimes I'm like, why are you, sometimes I'm like, I don't know why it's important to teach dialogue writing. Because it's so hard. And if you're not like really well trained in it, then you're just going to have to listen to like the most like cringe, like nails on a chalkboard dialogue.
Yeah.
But that's a really interesting way to look at it. And even just teaching scene flow and dynamics of like, maybe we don't have to have specific words. But we can look at rhythm and we can look at just the way that the moments move together.
Yeah. And I don't really consider myself a playwright.
We don't think ourselves as playwrights.
Yeah.
That method is helpful for me too.
Five written plays.
Yeah.
We don't think of ourselves as playwrights because the words seem secondary, I think.
Sure.
And the other thing that's nice about working physically before you write the text is that, Jacques Lecoq saw everything as text.
Yeah.
So I not only write with a pen on paper, I write with my body in the space.
Yeah. Telling
gesture and movement become just as important as the written words. Important. They're actually all part of the script. So if you're working physically, you're not only writing the words, you are writing the staging simultaneously.
Okay.
And so it's not the idea of, oh, I have the words and now I interpret it with physicality.
Yeah.
It's that the physicality and the words are sort of co-equal.
Okay. Okay. That's a really good soundbite. regardless of your devising or you're just acting, right? Mm-hmm. Like they have to be equal. And I think that it's because that's so interesting because I just was on a call with a school and like the students signed up to talk to me and I would say 90% of them said, I don't know how to make my body natural, or I don't know the gesture to do, or I don't know how to like do the right thing on stage. And I'm like, oh, but that's, and I always say it's called acting. So it's action based. It's not emoting. So that they're different. So you have to like get behind like what it is you want from that person, how to use your body to get that from them, or that kind of stuff. But like, that's awesome. And I think that teachers, write that down. Tell your students, it's brilliant. Like, they have to be equally together. Yeah.
And so, and it comes out of that idea of play again, where sometimes you don't know. I think most of the time when I'm coming up with a gesture or physical action, mm-hmm. I'm not always aware of why it's necessary in the scene, but I'm in a playful state in the rehearsal room.
Okay.
And I think students often feel like, oh, it has to make sense. What am I doing?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the right answer is. In the rehearsal
and room. Also, I think that students are also trying to, instead of letting their body come to movements organically, they try to emulate movements that they see, which feel false and uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And they think that that their bodies aren't capable of doing interesting things to look at. But in reality, like if they just let their bodies do what their bodies do, people are going to just want to watch so much more.
Yeah.
You know, if they're just being so just like honest with who they are and what their capabilities are and working at 100% of what they are capable of doing rather than trying to. They like Lin-Manuel Miranda, so they're trying to be him, you know, like,
yeah.
You know, like the reason they like Lin-Manuel Miranda is because he is so unapologetically like himself, and he's not the best singer.
Right.
He's like this short little weird dude, but like you're so gravitated to him because he's just like, yes, this is what I have to give you.
Mm.
So,
and that's what the devising approach gives you,
right?
You devising.
You work with what you have.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to pull from someplace that isn't, you can't pull from because you don't have it.
Right? So true. Well, and so many directors, especially like in high school, will like give line readings or like demonstrate or like micro direct, which that is like my worst nightmare. And like, and it's so interesting because so many of the people that do that then have great success, like with awards or that sort of thing, but the performances don't ring true. And I think that it kind of like circling back to like all that we were talking about today, like with the devising, like it might not be seen on a commercial stage, right? Like it's not, mm-hmm. it maybe isn't going to like play Broadway. But like you're actually creating authentic art, and that's the more important part of what we're doing, especially like when we're working with kids. Like we should be really getting them to like authentically be themselves and discover themselves rather than trying to like emulate commercial theater or to like be like the puppets of the director. And I love that the way, like, I mean, all the techniques that you guys have just talked about really like bring that to the forefront.
Yeah. I mean, I know most people who are involved in high school theater are not going to make a career in the arts.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so what's really important is to give them a sense of artistic expression and freedom and joy.
And a sense of self.
Mm.
And so I think by letting them devise and find their own way into things and not worry about making something that's, has a sort of commercial mm-hmm. outlook or more traditional approach.
Yeah.
You're actually hitting those goals.
Right. Exactly. Oh my gosh, I want to keep talking about all these things because you guys are so fun to talk about. But I want to make sure that we have time to talk about Petunia and Chicken a little bit more in depth, because that's something that you guys tour with. And I think that would be awesome for anybody listening that's like looking to get some like live performance into your school. Like, tell us about like more about the story, about like what people can expect. Like, just give us the whole thing.
Okay, so the pitch.
Yes, not the whole story, I guess. Yeah, give us the pitch.
Yeah. So it's an epic story of love and immigration on the turn of the century prairie. Inspired by these three books by Willa Cather. So Willa Cather grew up in a very, very small town in the sort of the middle of nowhere, Nebraska. And as she was growing up in the late 1800s, she was surrounded by a lot of European and Eastern European immigrants who had just moved to the Midwest, who were told that this land is prosperous and bountiful. Come make your home here. And they discovered that it was not any of those things when they arrived. And so her books sort of chronicle her life growing up. They fictionalize it, but they chronicle her life growing up. And they chronicle the lives of these immigrants that she grew up with. And so our story takes those books, makes them into one story about a Nebraska farm boy and a Bohemian immigrant girl. Which is now the Czech Republic, Bohemia. And it tells a story of love and difficulty and loss and prairie and the wheat. And it's really beautiful. It's about those struggles that people...
new to the country.
People new to any country always face.
Yeah.
But it's also a love story as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
We have live folk music. All of the music is old time and folk music that we've found that
It's been really interesting doing it. So we originally made it for a general audience. We didn't make it for school audiences.
Okay.
Then we discovered that there was a real educational benefit to it. So there's talking about the Homestead Act and talking about the historical backdrop, but there's also just talking to young people in small communities. How do you feel about your community? Are you going to leave for the big city? Are you going to come back? Are you an immigrant? What is it like if, you know, your parents are immigrants and you're a first generation American? What's that experience like? So it actually has a lot of access points. For students that we were surprised about after we made it.
Yeah, I mean, just listening to it, I'm like, oh my gosh, the community engagements that you can do with that, like even the idea of like the American dream and or the what you think it's going to be your life, and then the reality of that, like having a conversation with kids and their parents about that is like so fascinating that they could have that. Because I think that, I mean, that's something I'm in that moment right now in my life where I'm like, I thought it was gonna be one thing and it's something totally different. And this doesn't mean that it's bad. But like that, it sounds like such a great conversation starter for young people and for anybody though. And it's not a show that, it doesn't sound like one that you'd go to and just be like, oh, that was nice and fun and let's go get pie now. Like there's like conversations that can really come from that.
There's a story we always tell where we were in one small community in the Midwest performing at a school. And we were doing a workshop afterwards. We were talking to the students about the different decisions characters made in the play. And at one point, we were asking them, you know, about a moment in the play where Petunia, our main character, our Czech immigrant, she can either leave the small American town and go on adventures with her love, or she can stay and make sure her family doesn't lose their farm. And she chooses to stay. But we asked the students, you know, what would you choose?
Yeah.
Would you choose your family or your personal ambition or your dreams? And one girl raises her hand and she is an immigrant, and I can't remember from which country, but she says that she had to make that decision, that she left her mom behind and came to the United States.
Wow.
And the teacher told us afterwards that she had never told that story before.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, and that's powerful, though, too, because I feel like oftentimes the narrative that I think that people are, like, driven towards is that they have to choose family over personal ambition. But, like, how interesting that you get a student, like, who, like, could, like, vocalize a different point of view on that. And also she was able to share that and felt, like it was a platform and safe enough, and that the story like gave her that platform. Yeah.
That's amazing. I think you know, you make the art, but you don't really know what the impact is until you start to put it in front of people.
Wow. And so you're mostly doing this in like rural towns. Is that kind of like your jam?
We've kind of done it everywhere.
We've done it everywhere, but I think a lot of the schools that we've gone to have been in very small communities.
Sure, yeah. We've done fringe festivals, we've done your like local 1,000-seat touring house.
Sure.
But we've also done the town of 500.
And
200.
They bus in a couple of schools from there, yeah. You know, or whatever. So yeah.
So then if you were to go to a school, if a school was to book you, do you always do workshops after, or is there an engagement piece, or like, what is that?
Yeah, so usually we offer, as part of the visit, two workshops, because you've got two of us, and so we split up, and we can either do a theater workshop, or we also do one about Willa Cather specifically, and the themes raised in the play, more of like a seminar.
Sure. Oh, interesting. Yeah. So, okay. This is so cool. I really want to see now a production of this. And you can, because on your website, there's like a little like trailer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It. And it's so beautiful. You guys should all go check it out. And that one and The Darlings, the trailers are so well done. Like they give you such like a great sense of like what you're going to see. And then sitting with the two of you now for the last hour, like your personalities and like your passion just is there in the trailers too. It's not like sometimes trailers are like, what is this? But so if people are interested in like maybe finding out more about like how to book you, or like what do you guys go over the United States? Or are you just on the East Coast? Like how, like what's
the, we go all over the United States.
Okay.
It's, you know, it's about trying to book, enough venues in a region to make it doable. But I think one of the things we love about making theater together is we get to travel the country together. So getting in our car, hitting the open road, seeing the United States, it's a real joy.
Yeah. So if people want to know more or potentially like work with you guys, how do they do that?
So they can go to animalengine.com.
Okay.
There's a contact form, or they can also contact us directly. So I'm Kareem at animalengine.com, and Carrie is Carrie at animalengine.com. Right?
Okay.
It's pretty easy that way. And and we're available. Absolutely.
Okay. And so what else do you guys, you're touring with Petunia, Chicken and Petunia, Petunia and Chicken, I'm starting to lose my mind.
Yeah.
What else, is there other projects that you guys are working on or anything else coming up that people, if they want to like work with you or know more about your work, they should know about?
So this spring 2020, we're going to premiere our new work, Rabbit.
Awesome.
And so Rabbit is inspired by all the different rabbit children's books that are out there. And it tells the story of a young rabbit dealing with anxiety.
Oh.
And so it's meant for family audiences. It's our first all ages show.
Awesome.
Our director is an art therapist.
Okay.
And we're creating a companion children's book. And so our hope is that families will come and actually get real concrete tactics for talking to their children about anxiety. They can take the book home, spread that learning on.
Yeah.
And we're really excited. That's going to premiere this spring 2020 at the Crane Theater in the East Village.
Okay.
And we'll be doing regular shows, either monthly or biweekly.
Oh, that's so awesome. Okay.
Yeah.
And that's, so if you're in New York, you can go check that out. I will, when you send me when it's going to be premiering, I'll remind audiences so they can go. Make sure to check it out.
Oh, thank you.
I appreciate it. For sure. Because that sounds incredible. I love that. Yeah. Is there anything else you want to like plug, or any last comments or anything like that?
It's been a pleasure. I'd like to ask you some questions now.
Oh, okay.
And learn more about your work, probably.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, we can talk later for sure.
Yeah.
But no, this is, thank you guys so much for joining and just chatting. Like, this has been really enlightening. And if people have questions even about advising, is it okay? Can they reach out to you?
Yeah. We teach a lot of workshops on devising methodology and how you might lead your students through the devising process. And that knowledge, I think, is free to all. So if anybody wants to learn more about devising, they should definitely get in touch.
Awesome. So yeah. So everybody who's been emailing and wanting to know more about devising, now you know who should you talk
to.
For sure. So yeah. Well, thank you guys so very much. This has been so fantastic. As always, if you have questions, you can reach out to us and we'll put you in touch with Kareem and Carrie, and it'll be great. So thank you guys.
Thank you.
And pleasure. We'll see everybody next week. Bye.
Episode. If you enjoyed it, I would love if you would leave us a review or rate us on iTunes or Stitcher, or share us with your friends on social media so that we are able to help spread the word around Flipping the Script and inspire people to make art that matters across the world. As a thank you for taking the time to review us and share us, each month I'm going to be giving away a theater swag gift basket. All that you need to do in order to win is just share us and review us, and every month I'm going to select a review or a share at random, read it on the air, and if it's yours, you will be the lucky winner of this awesome theater swag bag, which is going to have so much stuff in it that's like essential for the theater nerd, no matter if you're a teacher or student or just an enthusiast. If you want to find out more about Re Theater and our programs, our online classes, and our community for educators, just go to www.retheaterco.com. Theater is spelled with an R-E. Or you can follow us on Facebook at Re Theater. If you want to know about the work that I'm up to and find out more about Re Theater, you can follow me on Instagram. I'm there all the time giving out lots of tips and ideas and just sharing about how awesome theater education is. You can follow me at @Lindsay_CuiavaBar. If you have any questions about today's episode or thoughts you'd like to share with us, or maybe you have some topics you'd like to see us cover in the future, I would totally love to hear from you. You can send me an email anytime at lindsay@retheaterco.com. Just make sure you spell Lindsay, A-Y, and I look forward to hearing from you. As always, thanks for listening, and keep on making art that matters.